This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. Joining us to discuss the latest developments with Cincinnati streetcar system, an auditor's report of findings on the Metropolitan Sewer District, budget problems in the city of Norwood, and other top stories of the week are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and Cincinnati Inquirer Hamilton County reporter Dan Horn. And you can join our conversation this afternoon at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Pat, Chris, and Dan, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's start with the streetcar, Pat. I mean, what in the world is going on with the streetcar now?
Well, it seems like there's one thing after another. And, you know, going through the winter months, we are seeing some dip in ridership. This week, it came out that they're going to have to relay some concrete along a portion of the track around Walnut and 9th in that vicinity. Right at the north end of the downtown half of the 3.6-mile loop that they've got. It's going to take about 4 days for that concrete to dry, which means that at least part of the route is going to have to be shut down for that time.
Yeah. Chris, any idea how much of the route they're going to shut down at this point?
Well, yesterday the city manager, Harry Black, came out with a memo basically saying that what they recommended was doing the work over 24 hours a day over a four-day period. And by doing it that way, they would only have to shut down the downtown portion of the loop. That means they could still run a streetcar in over the Rhine. And there were some other options that he put out there that would limit the closure even more. But they're concerned that this concrete slab that's disintegrating that they're going to have to replace will the warranty on this will be voided if they keep running the streetcar while they're doing this work. So they think that to be safe, they should just do the work over a four-day period, get it done, and then just have the streetcar running it over the Rhine. So they basically say this work had to be done in the spring. They've known about this problem with the slab for a while. Slabs, I guess there's two of them. And the reason that they had to wait was because of the temperatures, allegedly. You know, I'll be interested to hear more about this on Wednesday when the City Council's Transportation Committee hears it. I feel like I've seen concrete being installed in the winter months before, so the technical aspects of this will be very interesting to hear about.
Might that have something to do with the warranty issues, though, when you install it?
Could be. I don't know. It seems awfully complicated for basically putting more concrete into the ground. So.
Well, and that's kind of the story of the streetcar, is all of these seemingly small issues tend to become a lot more complicated once they're explored, and you know that kind of creates this sense that this project, this system, is a lot more complicated than maybe it was originally thought.
I'll tell you, there are, you know, the pro streetcar folks on council, you know, they just kind of shake their head at this. This is not something in their view that they should have to be voting on or really having any input on. This is. They seem to think that this is something the administration should have taken care of on its own without this public spectacle. But they're always, you know, we're in election year, and it seems like, you know, any negative drama that can be pumped into the streetcar aspect is going to happen. So take that for what it is, I guess.
So to them, this is just a bump in the road? Is that how they would look at it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of bumps in the road.
Because I think they still only have four of five streetcars running at this point.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. The one is, you know, there's been some warranty issues with the streetcar that keep having to be repaired. And, you know, there's all these little problems that have occurred. Someday, maybe they'll get the thing running in a way that, we don't seem to have these problems. In other cities, you know, I mean, I'm not sure that the problems have been this extensive. So it's kind of a curious situation. I will say that I recently rode the streetcar. You know, early on it was just very unreliable, and you didn't know when it was going to come because the real time arrival system signs weren't accurate or weren't even on, depending on when we're talking about. I took it to a couple appointments over the last 7 days, and you know what? I got to where I needed to go on time, and I waited about 2 minutes for a train the other day, and you know, it seemed to be working better. So this latest news, you know, is kind of a blow, I think.
Hey, did they get the situation with the real-time sign straightened out? I know that was
I believe that's pretty much resolved at this point.
They were working when I was trying to take it to certain places this week downtown and over the Rhine. So that's good news.
So, Chris, do we have any idea at this point when they're going to shut it down for repair?
That's going to be discussed Wednesday. I mean, okay. I think they want to do it before opening day, obviously, because you're going to have a lot of people downtown. Opening day kind of signals the beginning of Cincinnati's kind of outdoor festival, you know, great weather, better weather, I guess, season. And when I think they hope that the streetcar ridership will start to climb back up. You know, Pat's mentioned the winter weather thing and potentially that being a reason for the lull. I'm not sure I buy that's the reason more than the fact that it just hasn't been operated all that well and been hard to use on a reliable basis. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see if they get through this problem and we get to April and the weather starts to get better, whether we see better numbers out of this thing.
Yeah. And just to make sure I'm clear on it. When they do shut it down, they're not going to shut down the whole loop, right?
The final decision remains to be made, but the city manager's recommendation calls for only the downtown loop being shut down. So you can use it if you're in Over the Rhine.
It is ultimately up to city council to direct SORTA, the transit authority, to then direct their vendor who operates the streetcar for them to determine their hours and where they run.
Yeah. And Pat, as far as the ridership, what have the numbers look like? I mean, you say they've been going down.
They have been going down. They were extremely high the first 2 months in September and October, much higher than projections. And then since we've seen a pretty steady decline in ridership. The most recent numbers are out of January, where we saw a little over 30,000 rides taken that month, as opposed to back in September, more than 100,000 rides were taken.
One thing that isn't down is investment along the line. We just had another project announced this week. A logistics company is going to rehab a building on Over the Rhine and bring 40 new employees near the Findlay Market along the streetcar line. So people who are investing in real estate and, you know, looking to move to the downtown and Over the Rhine area, they are not shying away from the streetcar line. It is still, you know, it is still, I think, driving investment there.
They see it as a positive, and I'm sure they're saying these are just short-term bumps that we're hitting right now.
This line is going to be here for the next 30 years at least. That's and right. So they view that as there's a sense of permanence involving it, and that's what real estate developers like to see, and businesses who want to locate their employees in places with easy access to transit. So
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, let's talk to Jeffrey now. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello.
What's your question?
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Go right ahead with your question.
It's not a question, more in the comment. Well, actually, it's a question. I was wondering if the idea of maybe laying a temporary track instead of this incredible disruption and inconvenience that it'll cause to let this concrete set properly. Has this idea been considered?
Well, I'm not sure how they would go about laying a temporary track that wouldn't, the construction of even a temporary track, I'm not sure that would cause any less disruption than 4 days of stopped service. But I haven't heard anyone discussing that. No,
I haven't heard that. I don't know that there is such a thing as a temporary track.
I think even if you could do that, there would still be the warranty issues. I'm sure somewhere in the warranty, there would be some kind of caveat about doing something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And we had a mayor's debate on Tuesday. How did all this streetcar issues, transportation issues, how did all that play into that mayor's debate?
You know, there was a lot more talk, I thought, in that debate about expanding Metro's bus system than the streetcar. I mean, the mayor, of course, brought the streetcar up. He is, you know, he was a critic and an opponent of the streetcar project. And, of course, he lost that fight in December of 2013. His main argument against, or at least one of them, against Councilmember Simpson and Rob Richardson Jr., the former UC president, board chairman, is that both of them want to expand the streetcar. They, rejected that. I don't think that they want the race to be about the streetcar as it was in 2013. And they said that, you know, the bigger issue is bus transportation and getting that expanded and getting people to jobs more easily. Yvette Simpson kind of had a retort to him that, you know, with the mayor's first thought about increasing taxes was to start a slush fund for the parks, not to expand bus service. So, you know, I think that mayor's debate was pretty lively, and I think we're going to see a pretty lively race compared to 2013.
Yeah. Pat, what were your observations from that?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Chris just said. And, you know, I've spoken with all three candidates about their views on how the streetcar should be handled going forward, and I think we've got kind of a spectrum here. We've got the mayor saying that we shouldn't be putting any more money into this project, at least right now. He's not willing to consider that. We've got Mr. Richardson, who he kind of hammered the point. I felt that it's here. We just need to figure out how to manage it right. And then I believe he would also be in favor of expanding it in the future. And then Councilwoman Simpson, she likes to hammer home the point that peer cities our size around the country are being more aggressive in pursuing these alternative forms of transportation, particularly rail. And that's, you know, she didn't get much more specific than that, I didn't think. But she's definitely, you know, in favor of pushing it forward as well, I think.
Let's talk to Andrew, who joins us now. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask what the future plan is as far as expansion. Do we see the line going up the hill to Clifton or across the river to Newport? Or, you know, I'm very curious. As it sits now, it's neat, but I feel like it's not truly functional as it could be for our city. And I can take my comments off there.
Thanks, Andrew.
I think Pat can probably address Northern Kentucky better than I can. Yeah. But, you know, conceptually, the idea is, yes, to go up the hill, but there is no plan. They have not spent any money on it. They have not spent any time on it. So, yes, it should go up the hill is what kind of the general thinking amongst pro streetcar people. But as far as the route, that I think kind of remains to be determined. Back in 2013, originally the idea was to go up Vine Street. There's big problems with that because of Duke's main energy line going underneath Vine Street. If they had to move that, I believe the estimate was, I want to say $50 million, you know, and that's without putting any track in the ground. So that's a major, major obstacle. And I think a lot of people who are pro streetcar have started to think, we need to figure out a better way to do this. Pat can talk about Northern Kentucky.
Yeah, Pat, there are a lot of people in Northern Kentucky who'd be interested in somehow linking up the Cincinnati system.
Absolutely. There's already a kind of advocacy group formed across Northern Kentucky's river cities. It's a modestly sized group of people, but, you know, they had a big crowd at the opening day back in September. And there's even been a schematic put forth, not official or really by any sanctioned by any agency or anything like that. But here's the problem with Northern Kentucky. The biggest challenge there is there are so many different municipalities. And whereas, you know, along the northern edge of the river, it's really just one city. But regional cooperation in Northern Kentucky, it's not really what Northern Kentucky is known best for, cooperation amongst the cities. I think it is getting better. But, you know, that's probably going to be one of the biggest challenges beyond just designing it and finding the money to do it. But the interest is there.
Getting everybody to pull together to do it is the challenge. We will continue our review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. One of the big stories this week was the severe weather that moved through the Cincinnati area and produced 5 tornadoes. So we hope you made it through the week without any troubles. And keep in mind that spring's just a few weeks off, so more than likely we're going to see more severe weather in the coming months, so be prepared for that. Joining us this week for the weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and Cincinnati Inquirer Hamilton County reporter Dan Horn. And you can call us with your questions and comments at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And rolling back to transportation here, Chris, local officials have been pushing for some legislation in Columbus that would benefit our area in terms of transportation. Talk about what they're working on.
Yeah, so there's a transportation bill as a part of the state budget that had actually got a vote this week in the House, and it passed pretty easily. And it would do a number of things that folks who are excited about transportation in town are interested in. I think the main kind of thing that's flown under the radar here that's important is that it would allow counties to county commissioners to assess a $5 fee on vehicle registrations. And given how many cars we have registered in Hamilton County, I had the DMV look this up for me the other day.
It's got to be hundreds of thousands.
I was surprised because the population of the county is about 800,000. And so that's actually how many cars we have. I thought it might be even a little bit more than that, but
so it's a 1-to-1 ratio of cars to people,
roughly. Now that's not a, okay. I could pull the exact numbers, but I don't have them with me. But yeah, basically the county could raise nearly $4 million a year from this fee, and they can use that for a number of things. They could, you know, deal with bridges, deal with roads. The county has a major, major need to replace the Western Hills Viaduct, which it actually owns, and it's working with the city to do that. So this could be a source of money that they could bond out. They could borrow money based on it and contribute to that project. So if this thing makes it to Governor Kasich's desk, it could be a real boon.
And it would mean any county in Ohio could do this.
Any county, right. It could be Butler, Warren, Claremont, anybody could do it. And you know, I think it will run into political issues because it's an additional fee. There was some talk on the floor of the Ohio House of, you know, well, we should let people vote on this. State Senator Bill Seitz at that point sang the $5 subway footlong song, saying you really want us to vote on something that's the price of a subway sandwich. So you know, I think it'll get political, but I think that's an interesting source of money. There's also some money that could go to Hamilton County and any other county's transportation improvement district. Those are organizations that kind of oversee transportation issues in counties. So there's a little bit of money that they could compete for and grab from there. So I think those are kind of the two major issues in that transportation bill that people are looking at.
Yeah, and they're going to launch a study of the Eastern Bypass.
I forgot about that.
As part of this bill, aren't they?
Yeah, they agreed to cooperate with Northern Kentucky on the infamous Eastern Bypass that developer Henry Fisher has proposed. I think he might own some land over there.
I know
he
it's
might
called the Eastern Bypass, but where exactly would that run? Do they have any idea at this point?
There's a map of it, and it kind of goes way out there, kind of through, you know, through Claremont County. I think it would be, you know, Ohio officials have resisted this for years, while Northern Kentucky folks have pushed for it. I think everybody kind of maintains that everybody except the hardcore anti-toll people in Northern Kentucky kind of maintains that doesn't really solve the problem of the Brent Spence Bridge congestion or its safety issues with the lanes being so close together and so narrow. But Ohio kind of has come off the dime and said, all right, we'll take a look at it. We'll study it. Northern Kentucky's already – I'm sorry, the state of Kentucky's transportation cabinet's already taking a look at that Eastern Bypass, and I think that they're going to have a cost estimate on it this year. So it's interesting that Ohio would be cooperative in that in terms of our side of the river over here.
And Pat, isn't that one of the concerns about the Eastern Bypass? They just don't know what the cost would be at this point.
That's right. I haven't seen a cost estimate come out. But you know, if I could guess, it would have to be a lot more and take a lot more time.
Than the Brent Spence Bridge, you mean?
Yes,
yeah.
The Brent Spence Bridge.
I think the Brent Spence Bridge, they tagged that at what, $2.6 billion? Is that?
That's right.
That's the working figure today. I bet it's rising as we speak.
It raises about the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet estimates that it goes up about $70 to $80 million every month or year that passes by.
Something
I can't remember.
Like that, yeah.
But yeah, it increases quite a bit. It's probably a year, 70 to 80 million a year that we don't do anything about the bridge. The cost to either repair or replace goes up.
The thing about the Eastern Bypass too is it's not only paying for it, it's acquiring all that land along the way, and you have to go through a bunch of communities, and some of them will not want an interstate highway flowing through them. And
that's so Campbell County for one, for sure.
Right. Should the two states decide to go forward with it, though, I mean, you know, that those are issues they'll have to work through.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just curious, as far as the streetcar goes, how much of a disaster does it have to be before people in the media and the community at large start realizing what a mistake it was? I mean, this weekend it's going to be shut down. There's a big event going on. They're going to have to close streets to repair tracks. Back in December, they had three cars go down in the same on the same day because I guess they didn't anticipate it would be cold in December in Cincinnati, and they had to fly in the repair specialist because apparently they don't have anyone here in the greater Cincinnati area who's qualified to repair the cars themselves. I mean, it seems like every step of the way of this entire project has been an unmitigated disaster. And it seems like the media just keeps cheerleading it, like this is the greatest thing that Cincinnati has ever done to help with public transportation issues, which, from my understanding, this project was never intended to really address public transportation. It was mostly supposed to be economic redevelopment. I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. And by the way, he mentioned shutdown this weekend. Does anybody know anything about that?
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
But I might be wrong, but I haven't heard that they're shutting the streetcar down this weekend.
Yeah. Me either, but, you know.
Beyond that, though, his points about viability.
Yeah. So the reason I think that they have to fly, well, I know the reason that they bring in the mechanics from out of town is because this was manufactured and it is under warranty by this company called CAF. It's a company based in Spain. It has a subsidiary based in New York State, so... That's the reason that is the case. As far as what other point do I need to get to on that?
He brought up just a lot of issues that he feels have made it unmitigated.
Yeah,
and the fact that he feels like the media and a lot of city officials have been nothing but cheerleaders for the streetcars. So,
well, these guys may know a little bit more about the details on some of this. I haven't written nearly as much about the streetcar as they have, but to say the media hasn't done critical coverage of the streetcar, I'm not quite sure that's a fair statement. There's been a lot written.
Well, there's been a lot to write about.
We've been talking about some of the stuff that you guys have written this week and others have written. My colleague Sharon Coolidge has written quite a bit about that. Obviously, there are a lot of very strong feelings about the streetcar on both sides, and I think there were
strong feelings about it when it was being debated. But it was just in its planning stages too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really kind of come to it's like a social issue. It's like abortion or something almost in a way. I mean, opponents are never happy with what you do and neither really are supporters. So it's kind of the trick bag that we're all in in writing about it. But I think, you know, the fact of the matter is the project is here and under the grants that the city accepted from the federal government, it must operate it for 30 years. So I think it's incumbent upon the city and SORTA and the third party contractor to figure out how to make it work.
Well, and you mentioned the idea of permanence earlier, and you know, you just mentioned the 30-year mandate to keep it operating. One thing that I think everybody can agree on is that these projects are so long-term that not being almost 6 months in is a really hard scale to really draw conclusions that large, I would think.
Absolutely.
And speaking of long-term projects, I do want to get to Dan here on some of his topics, but one last thing here on public transportation, Amtrak, something you wrote about recently. There was a move afoot to try to expand the service in Cincinnati.
Yeah, there's a growing movement to bring the current three-day-a-week service out of Union Terminal along Amtrak's Cardinal Line up to a daily service. And one thing that pro-train people are really excited about right now is that the City of Oxford and Miami University have each committed $350,000 to build a new station platform in Oxford. Tons of Miami students from Cincinnati, tons from Chicago. The Cardinal Line connects Cincinnati and Chicago. So, you know, supporters say that if there was daily service, we could even have faculty, staff commuting back and forth between Cincinnati and Oxford on a daily basis. So, you know, that's supporters are seeing that as a sign that momentum is moving toward that. And Amtrak has even said that they're trying to get that to happen too.
But they're trying to get it to happen, but how likely is it to happen?
Well, most of the infrastructure is already there. Estimates are that it would cost around $2 to $4 million a year to in additional operations costs to run the Cardinal line daily instead of its current schedule. I'd say it has a pretty good chance within the next couple years, but it is hard to say at this point.
Our train, I think, and President Trump has made this point too. Our train infrastructure in this country is embarrassing. And you know, at one point, I lived in Illinois for about 8.5 years, and you know, they had an extensive Amtrak network that was well used. They set records year after year on people using it, and it was a situation where it didn't just connect big cities like Cincinnati, Cleveland, Chicago, Columbus. It really connected the rural communities and small towns together, and it was just really a well-regarded service by both Republicans and Democrats and independents. I mean, it was really a bipartisan situation. And it's funny to me how in Ohio it's kind of so politicized. I think this movement's interesting. I think it's got a long way to go, and you know, it might help if the train didn't leave at 1:40 in the morning.
Absolutely.
So, you know, all for it, obviously.
Dan, you've got an article this week that's titled, "What is the Matter with Norwood?" So what is the matter with Norwood?
I don't know if you got enough time. But
we could spend the rest of the show talking about this one, I take it.
That's a little unfair, though. You know, Norwood is a fascinating little town. It's, as many of our listeners know, that it's surrounded on all sides by Cincinnati. It's 3 square miles. It's one of the densest cities population-wise in the state. And when you go into Norwood to write about anything going on in Norwood, you learn pretty quickly that Norwood is a little like Fight Club, in that if you live in Norwood, you don't talk about Norwood. It's not, at least to outsiders. And so it takes a little time to get to know some people and to dig into the numbers and understand a little bit about what's happening up there. And in this case, I was hoping to do something beyond just a story about Norwood's having financial problems again, because they've had financial problems on and off for decades, even before the GM plant left in 1987. So we spent a little time going through the numbers and the budget, and a good number of their problems are long-term problems they've had going back for years that they share with a lot of other cities in terms of big personnel costs, retirement benefits costs, that kind of thing. And then they have some short-term problems of their own making that they're dealing with as well.
Yeah. How severe is this recent financial crisis? I mean, haven't they been placed in a fiscal emergency by the state?
Correct. Yeah. The state's going to set up a commission, and they will have to submit their recovery plan to that commission. Anything they do will have to go through that commission. And they're in the process of figuring out how that's going to work now. You know, they've been on a razor's edge with a budget for quite some time. They were kind of pushed over the edge by a couple things that happened. They had some bond payments that came due, about $2.5 million worth of those that they don't typically have to deal with. They had ongoing local government cuts that everybody's got to deal with. They had to repay about $1 million in earnings tax payments that companies had overpaid for. So they had a lot of things happen in the last 2 years that kind of nudged them over the edge. So beyond that, a lot of the structural issues they have are problems that they share with a lot of cities. And, Norwood has a lot going on there. It's not hopeless. It's not an urban hellscape up there. You know, they've got development, they've got hotels, they've got restaurants, they've got offices, but they don't have a GM plant anymore. And the people who work there don't make the kind of money GM workers make. They often don't live in the city anymore. They commute to their jobs. So it's a different economic beast that they're trying to get their arms around, and it's been a struggle for decades.
Well, you're saying even before the GM plant pulled out, they were having financial struggles. So the GM plant's the tipping point. Is that it?
Yeah, that kind of set them down this road. You know, GM had at the time at its peak, it had about 9,000 jobs there. It was down to about 4,500 when they closed in 1987. They lost a third of their tax base in a year. It just went away, and you don't just shake that off. And they seem to be taking the right development approach in the sense that they have a good central location. They're trying to get the kind of businesses and offices that like a good central location. They're building up retail, hotel, restaurants, office centers, that kind of thing. But again, those jobs typically don't pay the way a GM auto worker's job would have paid in the 70s and 80s, and those workers don't often live in that in town.
Yeah, how's this? Because they've been going through this for years. How does this latest fiscal crisis? How's it compare to previous years?
It's probably among the worst they've had to deal with in a since the closing. I would say, you know, the fiscal emergency is a pretty serious designation by the state. They don't do that too often. Norwood's been there once before, I believe. So this is probably the toughest place they've been in since.
But you have
GM
to marvel that they keep pulling themselves.
They do. They do. And you know, it's a proud town. They're, you know, they their population stabilized. The housing stock is not bad. You know, they're not destitute. They've got some potential there, but they're really trying to get their arms around some tough stuff right now.
You mentioned they have to come up with a plan in response to the state of fiscal emergency that was declared by Ohio. How tough is that going to be for Norwood to do?
Well, Norwood's auditor, based on stuff that was sent to him by all the department heads up there, put together a list of everything they could do. And when they presented that list to city council, it pretty much horrified everyone who heard it. It went from eliminating the health department to eliminating the police department, any number of pretty dramatic steps, most of which will never happen. But it gave them some idea of just you know, how tough this is going to be to find places to cut without cutting bone.
I love the story, and I think you said in it they had like 200 city employees, and you know, it just made me wonder. And I, not to pick on Norwood, because I kind of wonder the same thing about St. Bernard or one of the other kind of adjacent or donut hole cities. Why don't they take a look at being absorbed by the city of Cincinnati, do some annexation or something?
That's a question you hear an awful lot from people, but not from really anyone in Norwood. You know, as I said, Norwood is a very proud town. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find too many people in Norwood who would think that's something they want to do. And I don't think you hear a lot about that at city council either,
right,
in Cincinnati. I'm not sure they're eager to pick up a city of 19,000 with some of the financial issues they have. But Norwood is a very distinct place, even though it's completely surrounded by Cincinnati. It's always had its own identity. It's had its own culture and history, and people take a lot of pride in that. So I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are most of the city officials pretty optimistic, though, that they can pull out of this?
They are. They're not sure how they're going to do it, and there doesn't appear to be a consensus on how to do it at this point. A lot of times you get to this point and people say, well, you know, we're going to do X, Y, or Z. Right now, they're kicking around a lot of stuff, and there doesn't seem to be consensus forming around any one or two ideas that are going to bring it to heel. But cutting costs is definitely something they're going to have to do.
We will continue our weekly review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and Cincinnati Inquirer Hamilton County reporter Dan Horn. You can join our conversation, 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan, there's something else that you've written about was Ohio Auditor Dave Yost released his findings of a state audit on the Metropolitan Sewer District. So what did he have to say on this? What were his findings?
Well, this is the first of two audits that are coming. So this audit is not.
So is the next one going to be a bigger audit?
The next one will be a bigger audit.
Okay. Then
this is a more standard performance audit that looks at operations day to day. The one that we're expecting that's going to look into some of these bigger issues that we've been reporting on over the past year is a special audit that's not due for months yet, probably. This audit focused on how they do business over the course of, you know, days and weeks, and structural issues, financial issues that they found. There were not major findings there other than that Yost found that there are structural problems with the way MSD is set up. That was news to absolutely no one who knows anything about MSD. You know, the city runs MSD, the county oversees its budget, and they argue constantly about how to do
and
both
Yost
of those two
this
things.
Is unworkable. Okay.
Correct, and he's okay. Absolutely right. And so I don't think you'd find too many people at the city or the county who would argue that point. This is a structure that's not going to going to work for the long term. It worked for 50 years, but then things got really expensive and really crazy really fast. They're in the process now of trying to negotiate their way out of this thing and cut a new deal. They've been dealing with that in federal court for now almost a year. They stopped talking to each other for a while because that's kind of what they do with this stuff. But they're talking again, and you know, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. And any idea how long it might take for them to work out some kind of a deal? Do they have any kind of a deadline in mind for doing this?
The current deal expires at the end of this year. So, yeah.
They have
a deadline. Yeah. Now, what they come up with is anybody's guess at this point. But they're trying to hammer out how they can make these two pieces of the puzzle fit.
Now, did this most recent audit, did it look at how much local rates have increased with MSD?
It touched on rates. You know, as everyone in Hamilton County knows, our rates are going up and have been going up for years. There was no rate increase this past year for the first time in a long time. The state auditor basically did a comparison between what's going on in Cleveland and Columbus and here. He found that those rates are going up across the board, and that Hamilton County's average rates were in the middle, I believe, of those two. I think Columbus had the highest average annual rate, and Cincinnati was in the middle. But everybody's been going up pretty consistently. Ratepayers here got a reprieve this year. Commissioners decided not to approve a rate increase this year. But with a $3.2 billion reconstruction project underway, that's not going to hold for too long.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because Cincinnati is not the only major city in Ohio that's going through something like this, because I think in your article you pointed out that over the past 15 years, Cincinnati's up 196%. Cleveland's up 270. Did I see that right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay. And then Columbus, over the past 15 years, they come in on a little bit on the low end. They're up 115%, 150% on their rates over the last 15 years. So this is not entirely unique.
They all have the same problem. Basically, this is a problem all over the Midwest, especially a lot on the East Coast. You have these communities who built sewer systems centuries ago in some cases. Some of these things, even in Cincinnati, are 150 years old, some of these lines. And the systems were built for a city that doesn't exist today. And you have aging systems, collapsing systems, systems that are inadequate for where the people are living today. And they need to be fixed. And regulators want them fixed quickly. And that costs money. And, you know, that's where they're all in that same boat.
That big picture that Dan just described is so important here. I mean, this is a $3 billion project. It's like building, you know, three or four Paul Brown stadiums. And it really puts us at a disadvantage, I think, to other cities like on the West Coast that we are competing against economically. Those cities are, you know, when they built their systems, they built them in a way that separated, you know, the sewer. They didn't have combined sewer overflows where, you know, the sewage backs up into people's basements. It gets, you know, dumped into the Ohio River or the Mill Creek or the other streams and whatnot. So, you know, it's really interesting that the EPA has come down on these Midwestern cities. We're not the only one. St. Louis is one. There's some smaller towns even that I can think of that have this problem. So, you know, it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how the federal government deals with this under President Trump. And I think that this is, you know, one thing, for example, that our two U.S. senators want the federal government to help us on because of the high cost of it. And, you know, one other thing interesting about this audit was it took kind of a little bit of a shot at the MSD monitor that the county hires and kind of said, you know, we're not quite sure that the county and the city are getting their money's worth out of this auditor, and they seem to want to hear a little bit more about it. And of course, Charlie Winburn, who has been a longtime critic of this audit or the monitor, again called for his firing this week in at city council after he read this. I don't think that's going to happen because the county has the purse strings here, and I think they're pretty happy with his work.
On the county side, they couldn't be happier. They say he saved them millions of dollars, and even though they have spent millions on the monitor team, they say he saved them tens of millions of dollars. I think, you know, at its crux, this monitor issue and the argument about dysfunction over there, the monitor's existence is a symptom of the dysfunction. So it's through no fault of the monitor team, but the fact that you have to have a monitor team on top of the city government team that's running MSD tells you kind of all you need to know. You know, I know those folks. They've done good work. But typically you don't have a team within a team essentially doing budgets, reviewing invoices, and doing the same work to try to come to the same conclusion, but almost never coming to the same conclusion. It's a very difficult structure. And it is certainly not ideal. And again, that has nothing to say bad about either folks on either side of that operation. They're all trying to do the best they can.
It's just, as Joost said, it's unworkable.
It's just a very odd arrangement. It's certainly not one you would draw up or see in any kind of business manual, no.
What was City Manager Harry Black's reaction to this most recent audit?
You know, the city didn't say much about this audit. I mean, Gerald Checco, the MSD director, was generally pleased with it. He felt it showed that some of the changes they made over the past year or two have gone well, that they made improvements in general operations, in cost cutting, that sort of thing. So he was generally happy with it. You know, I think the bigger issues are going to come out in the special audit that comes out in the next few months. And it'll be interesting to see what exactly they find and how far back some of these problems go, but also how well they've been addressed going forward. Because I know the city's position is a lot of those problems are in the past now. We're done with that. We've continually seen that that's not always the case. They're working on it. But we'll see. The special audit, I think, will be a little more illuminating on some of that stuff.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. Bill joins us now. He has a question or a comment about the Brent Spence Bridge project. Hi, Bill.
Yes, very interesting conversation today. I did have a question regarding the Brent Spence Bridge. I'm no structural engineer, but, you know, going over it, it's all made of steel. I